coming to you direct from the nerve center of the galaxy's greatest comic. This is the 2000 AD Thrillcast.
Borag Thung, Earthlitz, and welcome to the 2000 AD Throwcast. I am the Husk, formerly known as Molchar, and we're jet-lagged and back from New York Comic Con. Thank you to everybody who came by the booth and said such lovely things, not just about the podcast, but also Galaxy's Greatest Comic. It was wonderful to see you. Really hope you enjoy your purchases. We had a great time. It's really great spreading the word of Thrill Power over in the States. And one of the ways in which we did this was the panel that we had. Unfortunately, we didn't get as many panels as we wanted at the show, but this one is an absolute doozy, and that's what we're bringing you on this edition of the Thrillcast. It's called When Comics Went to War, From Captain America Punching Hitler to Battle Picture Weekly. And our guests were Garth Ennis, who anybody who knows 2000 AD and British comics shouldn't need an introduction to him, but for those of you who don't know him, he wrote Preacher, he wrote The Boys, which has just been made in a TV show, and also he wrote Judge Dredd in the 1990s. Alex DeCampi, who is a writer for 2000 AD, who has written for the Dread movie tie-in, but also she's done Full Tilt Boogie for the All Ages issue that we did recently, and also she's got more stuff coming up which you'll hear about in the episode. Gary Thompson, who is from the Naval Institute, who are launching their own line of war graphic novels. This was a joint panel between Naval Institute and 2000 AD. And finally, Wayne Van Sant, who, his career is defined by war comics. He's done incredible ones about Vietnam, Gettysburg, Normandy, so many great titles. And it was wonderful to sit down with them and hear their opinions on war comics as a genre, what war comics can do, what they can't, how they integrate personal stories, how they tell the stories of great big battles without losing the human element. Absolutely fascinating to hear their accounts. So we're going to be hearing that panel in a bit. As always with convention panels, the recording isn't great, so you will have to listen closely. The only voice you'll be delighted to hear that is a little bit indistinct is mine. But hey, whoever listened to this podcast to listen to me. So we're going to crack on with When the Comics Went to War from New York Comic Con 2019.
Hello.
Morning.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the When the Comics Went to War panel. Wonderful to see so many of you here. I will crack on and introduce our esteemed panel. We start off with Gary Thompson from the Dead Reckoning imprint at the Naval Institute.
Oh.
And then it's some bloke. it's Garth Ennis.
Thank you.
And then we've got writer Alex DeCampi. And at the end there, we've got writer, and I think the only veteran on the panel.
Not combat veteran.
Well, you served.
I worked in the laundry.
Oh, okay, that's fine. Wayne Van Sant. So we'll crack up. The whole point of this panel, by the way, my name is Mike. The whole point of this panel is to talk a little bit about the history of war comics, how they've been something of a thread throughout the history of comics, how writers approach portraying combat and the personalities of people who go to war, the blurring of fiction and reality. We'll just basically riff on that. That sounds like quite a lot, doesn't it? To begin with. So, I'm going to start with Garth, actually, because what I wanted to ask was about your first experience of war comics, because obviously it's something you've come to be known for in your career. What was your first war comic?
The first war comic I read was Battle. It was a British weekly anthology. It ran, I think, from 75 to 87, something like that. It had six or seven stories each week, all black and white artwork. Some of them have been reprinted, things like Charlie's War, Johnny Red, Darkie's Mob, HMS Nightshade, things like that. That would be where I began reading that, I think, when I was 8 years old.
And this is kind of an obvious question. What influence did it have on you?
Pretty massive,
yeah.
I would say. Essentially, reading Battle and other war comics of the era, there was a couple of series of what were called picture libraries, and these were small A5 format 60-page comics with just one story. These weren't anthologies. They and Battle, I think, influenced me hugely. I think because knowing or slowly finding out as a kid that these stories, allowing for the hyperbole exerted on them, were based on real life, that people had done these things. I was reading about things that men and women had done in real life in the First and Second World Wars and others. And I think it was that led me into an interest in military history, and then full circle back to writing my own war comics, which I've been doing now for about 20 years.
Okay. Alex, what about you?
Commando comics, which were, you know, what Garth was describing, these, like, sort of, what they were, 60 pages, right?
Commandos? About that, yeah.
Like, sort of little, small, I still got a stack of them. If Americans, you should go on eBay and buy yourself a stack of Commando comics and put them in the bathroom. You will thank me later. They're the perfect length, okay. None of the art is credited. And you can have a fun game playing, like, oh, look, that's Carlos Esquerra. Oh, that's John Ridgway. Oh, that, you know, like, some great names of British comic art have all drawn for Commando. All black and white art, and they're just, you know, 2-3 panel pages at most. And they're just really, they're still being published to this day in Scotland. And they're just really wonderful stories. I got Battle as well, and I still have, I think it's the 1987 Battle Annual, which has Santa Claus with an assault rifle running over the top. It's one of my all-time favorite images. And, you know, similar to Garth, when I started picking up, I've always been much more interested in nonfiction than fiction. I mean, almost all that I read these days is nonfiction. And when you start reading about military history, it's really addictive. And in the UK, there are a lot better fiction military history series that kids get into at an earlier age, I think, than in the U.S. I mean, I don't think there's any equivalent in the U.S. to the Sharp series, Bernard Cornwell's Sharp series, which will teach you everything you need to know about the Napoleonic Wars from the British side, or the Flashman books, George MacDonald Fraser. They are incredibly politically incorrect, I warn you. I just did a reread, and I was like, oh, yeah, that's spicy. But they're wonderful, and the history in them is perfect. And they cover, like, First Afghan War through, you know, the 1870s, I think. Certainly through the American Civil War. And then there are wonderful, you know, nonfiction books. Ill Met by Moonlight, The Jungle is Neutral. God, I could go on forever. But once you start getting into reading about history and the crazy, crazy, crazy things that have gone on as people fought wars and the incredibly heroic things that have happened, it kind of becomes this weird addiction. Like, normal fiction, normal nonfiction kind of pales with the absurdity and the tragedy and the heroism of military history.
And same question to you, Wayne. What was your first experience
with war? Well, I think I'm probably older than anybody here. My parents were the World War II generation, so I grew up, and also, consequently, all my friends' parents were in World War II. And I grew up hearing real stories, sometimes very honest stories. But I started reading comics in the late 50s, and I remember the first Sergeant Rock, I remember the first Haunted Tank, I remember all those. And I loved them. I liked them. I really did. But I think what she said is true about the difference between here and in Great Britain. The first comic to me that was a very realistic comic, because I was after the EC era, but was the combat series that Dell Comics did. I don't know who wrote them, but Sam Glanzman did the artwork, and they were basically like documentaries. And they were just very hard-headed. They were very good, and that's what I like to see in a lot of the war comics today. But I kind of got away from comics for a long time because all there was superheroes, and that's something I wasn't interested in. So when I saw Savage Tales come out in about 86, I sent some work to Larry Hanlon, and here I am. He put me directly on the NOM after that.
Okay. And Gary, you're setting up the new imprint at the Naval Institute, Dead Reckoning. First of all, what was your first experience of war comics? And I suppose, has that influenced you to want to produce your own?
My first experience of war comics, actually, as you guys have been talking about it, it might have been one of yours, Garth.
Okay.
you've been doing this almost as long as I've been alive, so.
You're going to pay for that.
That's great. Cheered me right up.
I'll buy you a whiskey. I grew up listening to stories of Korea from my grandfather, and that was really my first wartime kind of stuff, and idolizing him and hearing all those true stories that he had to tell. About it, and I was a comics reader separate from that, and until much later when I realized people were kind of doing that those two things together, and that's when I was like, oh crap, this is great. This kind of I never really liked like lots of the kind of childish cartoony ones, like the very almost nearly superheroics in a uniform kind of stuff. I wanted to see stories that were like the ones my grandfather would tell me, and that's where the care for it really came from. So when I was working at the Naval Institute and they wanted to try and find ways to reach out and tell the kind of stories that we know exist in military history, since the Naval Institute is a academic military history publisher, they wanted to make sure there was a way that we could get these stories out to a wider audience, because we know, because we publish them and sell them, that most people don't read them, but we feel they're valuable. And so I just said, well, there's an easy way to make all sorts of information more accessible, and it was true of television, it was true of movies, and it's true of comics. So we just need to find a way to take more comics and give a good home to them so that people can learn more about the kind of stories that people really experienced and went through, and try and tell them in a truthful manner, and not something that's just, you know, G.I. Joe kind of bullshit. I'm sorry.
That brings me nicely onto a question I wanted to ask, is about why comics? Why, in your opinion, do comics work well when portraying war? Because obviously, they referenced books people have written about their experiences and about historical
dispatches,
Why do you think comics are, and do you think comics are the perfect medium for telling war stories?
I mean, I think it very much depends on the person who's telling it, because like I think in pictures, and I find it like that's just the way I tell stories. It's with images, and another person might come along and say, well, actually I'd much prefer to write this as a prose story. I mean, I think there are many different ways to tell those stories, and it's very much the pleasure of the creator, and you know, if I'm telling it, you're going to get a comic. The other thing I want to say, and this is kind of off subject, but like I think you don't have to have an agenda with war comics. Like, you can be of any... Like, no art is apolitical. You know, there's no such thing as apolitical art. If you think it's apolitical, you're not looking hard enough. But you can be of any stripe on the political spectrum, left, right, in the middle, believe in gun control, believe in the Second Amendment. Like, it doesn't matter. Like, you can still find the human interest, believe in the war that's being fought, or be absolutely against it. You know, the stories of the people fighting it are something that's unique and isolated and you know, can be enjoyed by anybody.
Yeah, I mean, not to oversimplify, but I think the answer to the question is comics are the perfect medium for war stories, because comics are the perfect medium for any kind of story. We can do anything with them. And yes, it does come down to what you, the individual writer or artist, which medium you find yourself working in.
As an artist, am I the only artist here? I mean,
okay. Yep.
I know I read a lot of history. I love to read just plain, flat, hard history that's just can be dry as dust. But you can pull something out of that. And I've done some Civil War stuff. you can't, there are no photographs of actual hand-to-hand, you know, battles of the Civil War, of the Revolution, or many wars. And you can produce some of that what you read. And I'm the kind of person, I love the accuracy of everything. I like to make everything right. I want to make the soil right. I want to make all the weapons and uniforms and equipment right. And there have been many movies that have never done that.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
There's just a lot of just junk.
The funny thing about the Civil War is there were no actual photographs of the war, because the photographs, the cameras were too slow. But it was the first war where there were casualties photographed. The Crimea was the first war where there was actual photography of the soldiers that was published in the newspapers, and the Crimea was about 10 years before the American Civil War. Both with the advent of the rifle, and I'll just stop now. But anyway, but so photography, like one of the reasons the Civil War was such a big deal is there were published photographs of battlefields full of corpses, and people started to realize the cost of what was happening.
One thing I did just want to ask about was to pick up on what you said, Wayne, about the detail of this and accuracy and portraying it properly. Because I'm reminded of a story that the late great Carl Tisquera told about working with Garth, where he said, "Oh yes, I very much enjoy Garth's stories, but he sends me a script and it says it has to be this particular tank." And it's always the ones I can't find on Google Images. So he was always like having to do his own research. But Wayne, I just want to follow up on the point about detail, how important accuracy is to...
Nobody ever said it was easy, that's for sure. Because I've had to dig for some things, and I've had people... Now, I don't say I've never got it wrong, but I have made some mistakes. But 99% of the time somebody calls in or writes in and complains that you did this wrong, usually I find that I'm right, and I've got the right thing. And with the internet, I mean, gosh, it's, you know, perfectly, you know, easy to find all the details in this stuff. I also draw from models, too. I like to build models of model tank, paint it white, you know, just to draw from, or planes the same way. But I know in my book, Katusha, of course, I've made two trips to Eastern Europe, and I wanted to get it so right. I wanted it to be the color of the soil to be right. Now, I live in Georgia, got a lot of pine trees. The pine trees in Ukraine, the bark is a different color. I mean, you learn little things like that. If you want to make it right, get it right.
Gary, when you're a non-fiction publisher who wants to do comic books, obviously, there's going to be a real emphasis on detail and getting things right. Is that a big challenge when you're doing something like this?
The biggest challenge, 100%. We've done a few books where I've been more okay with them being having a little bit more leeway depending on their particular style or the way that they want to depict something. But especially for any serious kind of book that really wants to get into the details of things, details absolutely 100% matter. And that's something that's come up over and over and over again, and it drives artists crazy, it drives colorists crazy, but if it's wrong, it's wrong. And we're going to hear about it. Garth and I have a book coming out in the spring. We're very, very... detail-oriented on that. One thing that's good about being located on the Naval Academy grounds is we're right next to a gigantic military history library. So I always tell people, if you have any doubt whatsoever, I have 1 million books all about military history 100 feet away from me. Just ask. I will find it. And you find small little details, things that don't you would never really think about, but I guarantee you, as soon as it goes to print and someone takes a look at it, I will get a letter, and I have gotten letters, and they're always handwritten, and they're always 15 pages long.
But in terms of the kind of stories you can tell in comics, as we said, you know, it's perfect medium to tell any story. Do comics bring something special to war stories? Is there some element to them that allows you to tell the story in a way that you wouldn't necessarily be able to do in another medium? You know, there's the detailed thing about movies and whatnot. Is there something that only comics can say about war?
Maybe because I just don't like dividing up media by what they're capable of and better for. I would say no, there really isn't anything specific. It's just that, you know, we work in comics, so that's how we tell our stories. If there's an insight beyond that, I'm afraid it's escaped me.
Okay, well, in that case, let's talk about the way that you frame your narratives in war comics, because, you know, there's a vast variety of different stories that you can tell. You can tell the grand epic stories of, you know, cavalry charge and all that, and you can tell really personal stories. And I think particularly Garth, the Sarah book you just did with TKO, where that's a very specific kind of small element within a much, much bigger conflict. When you're telling a narrative, do you like to kind of mess around with the framing of it and the focus of it? Is that, you know, with the war stories you want to tell, is that an important skill to be able to have?
Well, I'm not sure if this is what you're driving at, but one thing I try to do is I try to focus on what I think of as the heroism of endurance. I think in comics, we like the notion of the special force, the secret team, the little band of incredibly capable individuals who can do anything, you know, one man in the right place, that sort of thing. Whereas to me, not having been to war, but having read about it a great deal, it seems to me that that is not really the experience of most people who go to war. Most people do, as I say, practice the heroism of endurance. They're just there. And they're told that what they're doing is vital, and they're told that the mission or the attack that they're going on is going to win the war, but somehow it never does, and somehow the war's still going, and there they are in the foxhole, freezing, under fire, miserable. And to me, that there's something more interesting about that than the highly trained super soldier who drops behind enemy lines with his commando dagger and his grenades. And so that's something I try to focus on. I've discovered to my cost that it's hard to capture a whole battle while at the same time focusing on a number of distinct characters. So what I'll try and do is I'll try and create just a small group of characters, as in Sarah, the sort of seven-woman sniper team, and have them go about their daily business against the backdrop of the siege of Leningrad. But at no point am I suggesting that anything any one or two of these women can do can win the battle or end the war. What I try to get across is that the idea is that war is simply something that it's constantly there, it's not going away, and it's part and parcel of their daily lives, and all they can do is endure.
Wayne, I wanted to ask about some of your books, because you did books on Gettysburg and Normandy. What was the challenge there in summing up with what were, epic moments?
Well, if you get too far back on a battle, you know, you just might as well just go to a history book. I mean, you know, the map is great if you know how to know what it's saying and understand the symbols and stuff like that, but you're like doing one on Normandy, you're better off sticking to a few people, a handful of people. And you don't even have to make them characters. I know in I did some comics back in the 90s, some 32-page comics for a publisher about the Civil War. And I found sometimes, I remember I did one on about the Stonewall Jackson's Valley campaign, and I had several characters in there. And I didn't give them a name. I just have them there, you know, going through the and there's at the end of the one about that, there's that one of them has comes in contact with Jackson himself. And then the next book I did was on Antietam, and I remember I specifically drew some of those characters in the Antietam book, because they would have been the same units that went up through that one. And we got letters from people that just loved that. And it wasn't any point I was trying to make, But they just got a kick out of the same characters, although they didn't have names. They were just characters that I drew them, what they were wearing, what they looked like. Somebody had a big nose. And they recognized them as the same characters, and they liked that. And people want to see a story, I think, where they can identify with somebody in the story. That's why a lot of sheer plain documentaries fall short. It's just the movement of troops.
The realities of combat. A lot of art has, in regardless of the medium, has sometimes struggled to accurately portray what it's like. And so you get something like Band of Brothers, that came along, and all of a sudden people go, oh, this is amazing, because it feels real, it feels like I'm there.
Band of Brothers was unusual. I mean, there were very few units that had that cohesion and had stayed together and had reunions all through the years. That was an unusual advantage to that story. You don't find many things like that. I've talked to a lot of combat veterans from a lot of different wars, and some of the things they tell you is the same very frequently, but still the situation can be different, and it can be a different story altogether.
Alex, when writing combat, when writing about a historical moment, is there a line to be drawn where you stop with the harshness of the reality? Combat is horrible, but you're also making something to be read and to entertain. Is there a line where you can cross over, where it stops being entertainment and starts just...
It very much depends on the story,
right.
And it's kind of a sense you have as you're writing it. I mean, back to what we were saying about, I believe, I like to really restrict point of view to maybe one character, maybe two characters, and keep it very much their journey and have it be about ordinary people in extraordinary circumstances. Because, you know, the super soldiers never really, there's no consequences either to their action, of their actions, either to themselves or to the enemy. The enemy just comes back next week anyway. It's the Red Skull again. I think there's a lot that can be done by a suggestion. You don't need to show it.
Absolutely.
Because if you have the artist draw like someone with their guts blown out, like you end up like as a reader, you end up kind of focusing on those guts. You're like, wow, that kind of looks like spaghetti. And like it's you know, it's a momentary shock, and then it just becomes kind of bizarre. And if you have people reacting to things or things happening off panel, and then everybody coping with the consequences of it, you know, sudden horrible things happening as they do, it can be a lot more effective, because it also ties into your own, you know, anything that's happened to you. You know, you're while the awful thing that happens may be something that you've never experienced, you've certainly experienced, you know, something terrifying or traumatic, and if you focus on that, then you can. It's easier to build a commonality of experience with the reader than if you're showing somebody perforated by lots of bullets. I mean, every so often you're doing that Gonzo book where you show someone with like lots of bullets. You can see the bullet, like the background through the bullet holes and stuff like that, and that's fun. But you know, that's a very specific kind of book.
I'm going to at least only slightly dissent from what you were saying, even though I still agree with it to a large extent. There's certain scenarios where for some of the books that we've done, where I've always felt it's absolutely necessary to completely push it. There's a specific instance that comes to mind on a nonfiction book that we're doing that's coming out sometime in the future, but it's based off eyewitness accounts in the Leyte Gulf, and you know, we craft this narrative that takes all of these eyewitnesses and interviews that the people who fought in Leyte Gulf on it, and this one man tells a story about how you know, the Japanese were pelting them, and it hits a boiler and it just blows up, and he turns a corner and sees a man who's literally melting to death, and his skin falling off, and it's the thing that he said kind of defined almost his life from that point on. It's the thing that stood out to him more than anything, and when he closes his eyes, he still can't see it, or he still sees it. And so when we were getting to that point in the comic, the writer really wanted us to two, probably, he was like, this is far too gruesome. We really should probably take a step back for it. And it could be a wrong decision on my part, but I was like, absolutely not. This is a moment that defined this man's life until he died several decades later. I know that there's nothing that we can do in art necessarily that's going to scar you that much, but I want to at least give the suggestion that of how important this was to this man and to the guy who died. Show him melting. He yeah. must be melting. And so we have, unfortunately, a man.
Well, I think that's yeah. you know, I think that's yeah. a case in which you do it. I mean, I think you know, you use it sparingly and yeah. and for specific moments of emphasis, because mm-hmm. you can your objective is not to necessarily deaden the reader to violence.
Yeah.
Unless you're Cormac McCarthy and it's Blood Meridian. But that, again, he was doing that for a specific reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cool. I agree with that. When I did my book, Katusha, I tried to keep it a little bit low-key. I didn't want to show a lot of things. But when I did the adaptation of All Cry on the Western Front, I was illustrating someone else's book. And he describes a lot of very terrible things. And I figured for that, I had to draw them.
God, how important are the actual stories of veterans, of the people who are in these moments, when you're writing your comics? Obviously, you've got a story to tell, and an awful lot of actual accounts of battles can sometimes not have the nice, simple narrative thread that we want them to. So what role does that play in when you write these stories?
Well, I think, as was said earlier, when you read a good deal of military history, you'll come across things that you simply can't make up, that defy fiction almost.
Right.
Research is important anyway, but when you read personal accounts of things that have happened to people on what I've called the very knife edge of human behavior, I don't think anything goes further out than war, than armed conflict. You'll read things, see things, you just can't believe that you're certain must be invented, and yet they happen. They happen to real people.
And there are always these little asides in the book. They're like, and then this happened. And you're like, wait, go back to that.
Yeah, yeah. If you're interested in this kind of thing, there's a book I'd recommend by an English historian called Max Hastings. He wrote a book a few years ago. It was released here as Inferno.
Oh, yeah.
It's not exactly a social history of World War II, but it tries to encompass as much diverse experience as possible. So it's everyone from the experiences of everyone from a housewife in Leningrad during the siege to an American general to a Japanese fighter pilot to a British prisoner of war to one of the American soldiers who was first into Dachau. Things like he really just tries to get as many different points of view to the war as possible. And I find when I read books like that I almost find something that I want to write about on every page, something that makes me think, I cannot believe this. I would never have imagined this.
I know if you've ever seen the U.S. Army history of World War II, it started coming out at the end of World War II. I've got about 22 volumes of it, more of it than that. Big old thick green books you can get at the U.S. government printing office. And I remember, and this is the cold, you know, very boring history to most people. But if you look deep enough, you'll see things. And I remember one description. This was in New Guinea in 1944, after what they call the Battle of Drenamore. Very, one of the most unknown battles in World War II, but very bloody, on the coast of northern New Guinea. And the Americans had stopped from the Japanese attack and were advancing, chasing the Japanese back into the jungle. And it says in a very cold way, they came across a Japanese field hospital. And they advanced on it, and some of the Japanese prisoners were firing on them. And it killed several Americans. And this infuriated the American soldiers. And it's done in very cold language. And it says, they advanced on the hospital and dispense with anyone not surrendering. And there's a footnote that says, there is no evidence that any prisoners were taken. Now, that's pretty cold. And it was told in a very boring way. But you can, If you haven't imagined, it's like when Saving Private Ryan came out. Everybody saw that and were so stunned by the Omaha Beach scenes. And I've been reading military history all my life. I thought, well, what did they think that was going on there?
What do you think is the enduring interest in telling war stories in comics? Because you get such a range. You've got Captain America punching Hitler. You've got British strips like the Steel Commando, which, for those of you who don't know, it's basically the British developing a robot that imprinted itself onto the laziest man in his platoon and would only obey what he did. It's just like a constant comedy straight out of sort of Spike Milligan's memoirs, but with a robot. But then you do start getting a lot more realistic war stories being told. We recently announced that we're going to be publishing Hugo Pratt's war stories that he did for the British market. That's coming out next year, and they're beautiful. But of course, he lived during the war, so you know it's a certain kind of portrayal. But the question is, why do you think there is this enduring interest in writing war stories in comics? What do you think propels us as creators, as publishers, to keep telling these stories?
Well, I suppose, if you're talking about the kind of stories where Captain America or the Steel Commando were fighting in World War II, that's fantasy. Wouldn't it have been nice if brightly coloured people could descend from the sky and wipe out the Nazi hordes and give Hitler a good sock on the jaw? That's fantasy, and it has its own appeal. Not to me, but there is obviously an ongoing interest in it. I mean, I do think that people do like that Nazi iconography. I think at one point they said that if you could get a swastika under the cover of a book or a comic, the seals would go up, just because people know there's going to be some deep, dark shit in that issue. So people love all that stuff, and they love the Nazis and the legions of tanks and perfectly attired stormtroopers and so on. For me, though, I have no interest in that side of things. It's what I talked about earlier. It's trying to get across the stories of people who lived these incredible experiences, the stuff you can't make up. And to an extent, I think, given what the World War II generation did for us, I would like to keep their stories alive. I mean, they're almost gone. If you were 20 in 1940, how old are you now? There's not many of that generation left, and I would like to preserve their stories and get them out to new audiences.
I mean, I think there's an ongoing. It's not just World War II. It's Korea. It's Vietnam. It's our current war, which is now old enough to actually enlist on its own. It turned 18 last year. And there's just other stuff going on. I mean, for me, I write a lot of horror stories, and I always kind of forget to put in like superpowers and magic and Lovecraftian space horrors, because there's so much you can do just with people. My Russian submarine story, which someday someone will love and nobody wants, but I'm going to do anyway because I don't care. You keep hearing these stories of these Russian submarines, nuclear subs. One very recently, way down at the bottom of the Arctic Ocean. Okay, it's a submarine anyway, and I'm claustrophobic, so being on a submarine at all, it's like, nope. And here's this thing, at the bottom of the Arctic Ocean, starts leaking radiation, engine goes on fire. You can't go up fast enough, everybody will die. So you're stuck on this thing, which is leaking radiation and burning, and at the bottom of the Arctic Ocean. And they actually managed to put out the fire and get to the surface and keep from basically irradiating the Arctic. That's just something that randomly happened like last February. That's a story. That's a hell of a story. So I think also, war isn't over, and we still have a whole bunch of people deployed in combat situations around the world. And whether you believe they should be there or not, I have friends who are currently serving. I have friends who are very recent veterans. Their stories also need to be kept alive, and their stories are just as horrifying. You know, I mean, it's like, we're not going to play top trumps about this, but you know, it's like there, it's always like war combat situations are always terrifying and always kind of fascinating because they're so horrifying. And you think, I could never get through that, and then you're seeing these people who did and who are, you know, who are just as flawed as you are. You know, they're certainly not superheroes. And they made it through. They made hard choices, some of which, you know, they saw things they'll never forget. And so there's always a new, this, you know, unfortunately, like someday, like we can all look forward to the day when there will be no more war stories, but it's not going to happen for a very long time. And until then, it's kind of our duty to remind people of that we're sending our young men and women to places to get shot at.
I mean, your whole career has been defined by war comics. So what's your take?
There are just so many stories out there. There's so many stories that to me are worth telling. I grew up, you know, reading Sergeant Rock and watching John Wayne movies on television, black and white, of course. And I read more into it. And then I realized that the war... And wars are happening everywhere. I mean, I was told that the war ended in 1945, and then we had Korea, and then Vietnam. But there was no peace during that time. There were wars everywhere. There are wars everywhere now. I mean, gosh. And the more I've read about the Russian front at World War II, there were many wars going on during that war within the realm of the Russian front. And it's just, you know, sometimes the human race is very disappointing. But I think these are all stories that need to be told. And my father was in the Navy. He was on a sub chaser in the Atlantic, mostly in the Caribbean. And they chased, they may have sunk one U-boat, I'm not sure. But they spent a long time at Guantanamo. And when I was in the Navy in the late 60s, early 70s, I spent a lot of time in Guantanamo, and I had very fond memories. If they were closed that prison, they're going to make it into a motel, we're going to go down and get a room, me and my dad, and relive all that. You know? But, you know, and when you get down to it, all these veterans we talked about have seen terrible things, also have good memories. Those guys in Band of Brothers wouldn't have got together all as much as they did if they didn't have good memories, too. If you've ever been to a bunch of guys that were from World War II or any war like that, they have warm feelings for each other. My brother's brother-in-law was a captain with the 1st Cav in Vietnam, and he goes every year. You know, there must have been something good about it.
But that was one question I wanted to ask about obviously war is hell, there's lots of horror, lots of terrible things. But when you're writing something, and perhaps the audience may be hopes for a happy ending.
Sure.
And how do you kind of moderate, in a way, the horror so it doesn't just become bloody depressing?
Well, I've always wanted to do a book. I wanted to call it The Circus of the Century, and about people that had a great time during World War II. And a lot of people did. That might be something to think about, Garth. Oh. I mean, yeah, there's a bunch of stuff, you know. My dad was from Douglas County, Georgia. And he spent a lot of time in New York City during the war, and he loved it. He loved every day of it.
There are a couple of great histories of New York City during World War II, and they're fascinating.
Oh,
I mean, you know, a Japanese spy who owned a shop selling porcelain dolls, and like, you know, the first time an airplane crashed into a major New York landmark.
Yeah, B-25 into the.
Empire State. So yeah, like sometimes it's not about the battlefields, and there's just this crazy, wonderful, mad stuff that happens with people, as Garth says, living on the knife edge of human experience. I mean, George Padgett smoking a cigar all the way down the valley in charge of the Light Brigade, which, you know, he's got his reins in one hand, the cigar in the other. Where's the gun? He was an officer.
I'm thinking about trips that you've done, Garth, such as Sarah, and also Screaming Eagles?
Dreaming Eagles.
Dreaming Eagles, there we go. Do you enjoy the fact that with comics you can tell stories that people won't necessarily have heard, particularly, you know, stories that involve women, people of colour, where they've been kind of whitewashed a bit out of history.
Yeah, I do like to do that. One thing I do whenever I deal with specific battles or military units or individuals is I do try to fictionalize the stories, by which I mean I don't want to take a person who actually lived and portray them as a major character and put words in their mouths and give them opinions that they might never have spoken or held. Because I think that's disrespectful. When I wrote Dreaming Eagles about the Tuskegee Airmen, I wouldn't have been comfortable taking, say, Lee Archer or Roscoe Brown and making them the lead characters, and for six issues having them say things that for all I knew they would never have said, or held opinions about whatever was going on that they never held. That's why I created fictional characters. Now you can't get away with it completely. Dreaming Eagles, I had to get Benjamin Davis into the story because he looms so large in that story. The book that I'm doing for Gary, The String Bags, which is about British torpedo bomber operations in World War II, deals with three real battles, the attack on Taranto, the hunt for the Bismarck, and the Channel Dash, and real people obviously did those things, and I don't want to feature the real people too strongly, because again, to me it's disrespectful to simply turn them into characters for your own point of view. So I create three fictional characters and have them doing the things that happened in those historical instances, and I have the real people in the stories but very much in the background.
And there's something I probably believe everyone here would probably buy into, but we discussed a lot in military history things, the Disneyfication of World War II, where just they touch on, a lot of people touch on very similar topics. They tap onto the big popular, you know, hurrah kind of stuff, and it plays into this very easy, too easy idea that feeds into itself of good guys versus bad guys and everything. And I think as a publisher, and as a publisher who deals with a number of other things outside of comics, there's always a major pushback in military history about keeping that from happening even more than it already does. Trying to find those stories that aren't quite as well known, that really showcase the truth of everything. Even though there's a lot of stories that get told over and over again that do contribute to that Disneyfication that are just as true, but it's like when you keep focusing on them over and over again, it kind of perpetuates a narrative that that's all the main stuff that happens. So I like, sometimes people tell me, or they ask me if we're interested in talking about things that aren't necessarily pro-American or really pro-allies or something along those lines, I always say, well, yes, of course. Like, if it's true, it needs to be told, and if it helps develop people's understandings about this particular point in time in history, then it absolutely needs to be told. I've frequently thrown out the idea of a book or a topic just about the liberation of Paris by the Americans. It's like a weird time, because the country's freaking overrun by Nazis. It's very, very not free. But they're still Germans. They still run it everything like clockwork. They weren't allowed to smoke when they were on duty. They weren't allowed to do anything. They had to run it like very ship shape. And the Americans come in and everyone's super happy because they're not being oppressed by the Nazis anymore. But a lot of the Americans that came in there have heard all these stories about Paris and Paris women and all this other kind of stuff, and it was a shit show. They were super happy about it, but at the same time, kind of like, thanks a lot, guys.
Well, also the liberation of Berlin.
Yeah.
And what happened afterwards, because the Americans got to the American sector and were looking around being like, shit, we need some people to run this town. Mm-hmm. And then they're like, well, he wasn't very Nazi. He was only a little bit Nazi. He was in the SS. So there was a lot of like weird, shady shit. Because like, also everyone focuses on East Berlin because, you know, the World War II bleeding into the Cold War and the wall. But a lot of the really crazy stories, and I've got a spy story, it must be Berlin in 72, so, a lot of the crazy stories were happening in West Berlin and about the continuance of Nazism under almost just another name. I mean, you know, look up the Gehlen organization, look up the man who ran that. He wasn't a good guy.
Yeah, and so much of this just exists in the gray areas of things, and they don't get.
Yeah, we won the war. Like, yeah, my favorite narrative is we won the war. Like, yeah, what now?
Yeah.
We won Iraq. What now?
Do you think that there's a tendency to overfocus on combat and not enough necessarily on the enduring legacy and aftermath of that combat?
Yes. also, the bits between combat. I mean, one of my favorite war stories is Shigeru Mizuki's Onwards Toward Our Noble Deaths, which is World War II from the Japanese side, and most of it is just it's like boring, boring, boring death, boring, boring, boring death, and he reflects that in a really wonderful, lighthearted way about their companionship and the people he didn't get along with and the absolute terror of things that would suddenly happen to them. So I think there's it's easy to focus on big battles and big heroic moments, but, you know, there's one thing to win the war and there's another one to win the peace, and we frequently don't follow through very well.
We're coming to the end of our time. I'd like from each of you a recommendation for, sorry, it doesn't have to be in collection, but a war story in comics that has profoundly affected you, or that you think is a particularly good example of the performance. Go first, Gary.
Go first, Wayne.
Oh, gosh. I've read so many of them. That's almost impossible to answer that. I really can't. I've read so much, I've talked to so many veterans and heard some of these stories, and it's like you said, the stories in between the stories, in between the combat, are some of the most interesting things and what people did. I have an uncle that was in the Signal Corps. He spent a year on Bougainville. I mean, can you imagine? That would have been really exciting. A year on that jungle island with nothing to do but string a few phone lines there and then. But I've heard specific stories of things that people have told me that just ran my blood cold. And I've talked to a lot of veterans, but I haven't talked to that many people who have actually admitted killing anybody. Let me tell you a story of Joe Donald. Joe Donald's one of my best friends. He was in the 173rd Airborne in Vietnam. I met him after working at Six Flags over Georgia when I was in college. And several years later, I was over at his house, and he was showing me his old uniform. He showed me his had this presidential unit citation badge and all that stuff, you know. And then he showed me an NVA officer's belt buckle. It was a brass buckle with a red enameled red star on it. And he told me about, he said, I remember the night I got that. He says, Lieutenant Tillman says, I was going to get my tail shut off going crawling out there and getting that belt buckle. And he was telling the story, and I didn't understand it. I said, what, you crawled out at night to get it? And he began to realize he was telling a story that he didn't want to tell and couldn't back out of. He said, well, I saw it through the starlight scope, and they were on an ambush. And I said, well, how did you know it was there? And he finally says, I knew it because I had just killed the man that was wearing it. And I have, of all the people I've talked to, very seldom have had anybody to tell something that just brazen. And you could tell it embarrassed the daylights out of him. And I don't know, things like that probably made more of an effect on me than anything else.
I mean, God, it's hard. I mean, because so many of the, because I was eating those stories up like popcorn because of Commando and Battle and all that. I mean, I'd probably say Onwards Towards Our Noble Deaths, just because I think more people should read it.
For me, I think it has to be Charlie's War. Charlie's War was a strip that ran in Battle from 79 to 85. Mike's outfit, Rebellion, have just brought it out in three very nice reprint editions. It's the story of a young lad called Charlie Bourne, Londoner, who joins the British Army, lies about his age, and joins the British Army just in time for the Battle of the Somme in 1916. And it takes him from the fighting on the Somme through to the end of the war. There's some time spent on the home front, but it examines as many aspects of the ordinary British soldier's lot in World War One in amazing detail. Brilliant writing by Pat Mills, wonderful artwork by Joe Calhoun. Absolutely unforgettable experience. Can't recommend it enough.
Side comment, once you start getting into military history, you learn a lot about Belgium.
Yeah. Yeah, I kind of went a little brain dead earlier because when you mentioned Onward Towards a Noble Death, I was just like, damn, that's a really good one. Yeah, that's really great. And so that's kind of all I can think of. But as a side story to that, Showa, a similar yep. kind of a thing. Much, much longer, several volumes.
Japanese or New Britain.
Yes.
Absolutely, just read it. If you're very interested in the Japanese side of World War II, it's 100%, 1,000% worth it. So, yeah.
It's worth mentioning because Battle Picture Weekly has come up quite a few times. Next year, Rebellion are doing a battle special, so we're reviving one of the groundbreaking comics of British comics. Have you got something in the battle one?
I'm doing Rat Pack.
Doing Rat Pack, and
I'm doing a Vietnam story.
Doing a Vietnam story. So, reviving a well-known name and continuing that legacy of telling fascinating war stories.
And this is funny. This is a veteran because I was talking to the artist Skylar Patridge is staying with me. She lives in the Southwest and we're doing a book together. And I was telling her about my pitch to Battle that got accepted. She turns around and she goes, "Oh, my dad did that."
Really?
Yes.
Oh my God.
Yes. Yes. I was like, "Oh, that's what he did in the war," and I'm like, "Okay, well, let me see if I can get you to draw it." So, yeah, once you start talking about these stories, it's amazing how many people pipe up and say, "Well, I did that," or "I know someone," or "I have a relative who," and then you end up with more stories, and then you just keep writing more stories for the rest of your life.
Our time is up. A huge round of applause for our panelists. Thank you very much for being here.
I hope you enjoyed that as much as we did, Earthlitz. Many thanks to Garth, Alex, Gary and Wayne for taking part in the panel. Thanks to everyone who came and listened. It was a packed house and it was delightful to see such a response. Don't forget the Treasury of British Comics line will continue to bring you the best from the old IPC archive, including titles such as Charlie's War, which we've already published. And we've got plenty more online, as you heard in the panel, some exciting news about next year with the specials that we're bringing out. So keep your eyes and ears peeled for more information about that. In the meantime, I was Molchar, but now I am merely an animated shadow who continues the great work of spreading word of the galaxy's greatest comics. Until next time, Splendid Verthrig, Earthlitz.
Fell power levels dangerously high. Alert! Alert! Read 2000 AD every week. Ask your comic book store or newsagent now. Subscribe to the galaxy's greatest comic at 2000adonline.com. Subscribe digitally on our apps for Apple, Android, and Windows 10. And download DRM free copies from 2000adonline.com. Alert! Alert! Stand by for urgent updates. Search for 2000 AD on Twitter and Facebook. Watch the latest videos at youtube.com/2000ADonline and follow on Instagram at insta2000AD. Program complete. Shutting down.